Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are looking at something that is, well, it's likely holding up the roof over your head, maybe the bridge you drove over this morning, or even the hull of the ship that brought your coffee beans across the ocean.
It's everywhere.
It really is. We are talking about the microscopic backbone of modern infrastructure, steel welding. But we're not talking about the sparks or the helmet or that smell of ozone. We are zooming in way into a paper from 1987.
A classic from M. Strangwood in HKDH Padacia at the University of Cambridge.
It is. The title is a bit of a mouthful. The Mechanism of Acicular Ferrite Formation in Steel Weld Deposits. Now, before I get on a roll and start hyping this up as the battle of the century.
I am going to have to interject right there.
We're, what, 30 seconds in and I'm already getting pulled over?
Just a slight course correction. I'm looking at our other source for today, Pragmatic Principles of Scientific Communication. And it explicitly advises that when we discuss this specific work, we have to strip out the hype.
No husk.
No exaggeration.
Yep.
No superlatives.
So I can't call this the most mind-blowing discovery in the history of metallurgy.
Definitely not. The goal here is a precise, factual analysis. The science is robust enough that it doesn't need us to dress it up. We just need to present the evidence exactly as the researchers did.
Fair enough. I will keep the drama to a minimum. Let the data do the talking. So let's start with the subject itself, acicular ferrite.
Sounds complicated.
It does. It sounds like a spell from Harry Potter, but in the world of welding, this microstructure is, you could say, the hero of the story.
It is the gold standard. And the reason isn't magic. It is purely mechanical. The presence of acicular ferrite in a weld correlates directly with improved toughness.
Which means?
Factually speaking, if you have this structure, your weld is just significantly less likely to break under stress.
Right. And by 1987, when this paper was written, engineers knew that. They knew if they saw these chaotic little needles under a microscope, the steel was tough. The problem was they didn't really know how it got there.
That was the mystery. You had two main camps, or theories, about how these crystals actually grew. One side believed it formed via diffusion.
That's the wanderer theory, right?
Essentially, yeah. In a diffusion-based transformation, atoms just move around randomly. They sort of jump from place to place, uncoordinated, until they find a new spot. It's a slow, disorganized mixing process.
And the other camp?
The displacive camp. They argued it was more of a coordinated military-style shift. The atoms don't wander, they shear. They all move in lockstep, just a tiny distance, to snap into a new crystal structure almost instantly.
So the mission for Strangwood and Padacia was to settle this debate, wanderer or soldier. But to do that, you can't just look at a cold, finished weld. You've already missed all the action.
Exactly. It's like trying to figure out the choreography of a dance, but looking at a photo of the final bow.
You need to see the dance. Or in this case, you need to catch the steel right in the middle of transforming.
Which brings us to their experimental setup. You could call it the experimental trap.
And they couldn't just grab a piece of scrap metal. They had to be incredibly precise.
Precision was everything. They used a manual metal arc technique with very specific parameters. 180 amps for the current, 23 volts DC positive. The whole joint geometry was up to ISO standards.
Why do those specific numbers matter so much?
Because welding is inherently chaotic. You've got intense heat, rapid cooling, all these reactions happening at once. By locking down the voltage and current, they made sure the heat input was consistent. If you don't control the variables, you can't trust the result.
But the biggest problem is just the speed. The weld cools down so fast. The transformation from the hot parent phase, austenite, to the cool ferrite happens in the blink of an eye.
So to solve this, they engineered what they called a high hardenability weld. They deliberately tweaked the chemistry, adding specific amounts of manganese and silicon.
They basically made the steel a bit sluggish.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. By increasing the hardenability, they slowed the whole reaction down. They made it so the steel wouldn't transform immediately when it cooled.
And then came the really mad scientist part of the setup. They sealed these samples in quartz tubes.
Filled with a partial pressure of pure argon.
And the argon is just to?
To prevent oxidation. If you heat steel to 1200 degrees Celsius in regular air, it'll just rust and scale instantly.
What?
The argon creates an inert bubble.
So they heat it to 1200 degrees. That turns everything into the parent phase, austenite. That's the starting line.
Then they quenched it, cooled it rapidly to room temperature. The whole goal was to freeze the process halfway so they'd get a sample with some of the parent austenite left and some of the new acicular ferrite growing inside it.
Okay, so they've got their frozen sample. Now they look under the microscope. This gets us into the morphology, the shape of things. What did they actually see?
The paper describes them as lenticular plates.
Lenticular meaning lens-shaped.
Yes. In a 2D slice, like under a microscope, they look like needles. That's where the name acicular comes from. It's Latin for needle-like. But in three dimensions, they're actually thin
Like
plates.
little surfboards.
Very, very small surfboards, yes. They found the aspect ratio, the thickness over the length, was about 0.3.
But other types of ferret can form plates too, right? Like Widmanstetten ferret. What makes this stuff visually distinct?
Location. That is the critical difference. Most other ferrites grow from the grain boundaries.
So if you picture a tiled floor, that's like moss growing in the grout between the tiles.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's grain boundary nucleation. But acicular ferrite is different. It nucleates intragranularly.
So it starts growing right in the middle of the tile.
Deep inside the grain, yes.
But crystals don't just appear from nothing. They need a seed to grow on.
Right. And in this case, the seed is an inclusion.
Which is basically an impurity, isn't it? A
Yeah.
tiny speck of slag or an oxide?
In almost any other context in metallurgy, inclusions are the enemy. You try to get rid of them because they can start cracks.
Yeah.
But here, they're the foundation. The acicular ferrite plates sprout right off these non-metallic particles.
And because those inclusions are scattered randomly inside the grain.
The plates just shoot out in all different directions. You get this kind of starburst effect or a random basket weave pattern. It looks chaotic.
The paper mentions something called hard impingement. Sounds pretty violent.
It's a microscopic collision. You have all these plates growing from different seeds, so they inevitably crash into each other. They impinge. And this collision stops them from growing into long, perfect plates.
They're all fighting for space.
Pretty much. And there was one more visual clue, something they saw with an electron microscope. These plates aren't always solid blocks.
Oh, right, I remember this. The subunits.
Exactly. A single plate of acicular ferrite is actually made of even smaller stacked slivers. And this was a massive hint because we see that exact same structure in another microstructure called bainite.
Okay, so it looks like bainite. It has the same internal structure, but looks aren't proof. This takes us to the smoking gun of the paper, surface relief.
This is probably the most elegant part of the whole thing. The concept is pretty straightforward. Imagine you have a perfectly flat rug on the floor.
Okay, picturing a rug.
If you and I just walk across it randomly, that's our diffusion model, the rug stays flat. We've just swapped places, but the overall shape hasn't changed.
But if we get on one side and shove the whole rug.
It buckles. It folds up. That's shear. That's a displacive transformation. And if acicular ferrite forms that way, the surface of their polished sample should physically buckle when it forms.
But that's got to be on a tiny scale. You can't see that with the naked eye.
No. They use a technique called Nomarski interference contrast microscopy. It uses polarized light to detect incredibly small differences in height. It turns invisible slopes into visible contrast.
And when they look at the acicular ferrite.
They found clear, undeniable surface relief. You can see it in Figure 5 of the paper. The surface is not flat. It has these distinct upheavals where the plates formed.
So the atoms didn't drift, they sheared. The material literally changed shape on a micro level to make room for the new crystal.
That's the implication. This result pretty much rules out the diffusion theory. If it were just diffusion, the surface stays flat. The fact that it buckled means the atoms moved as a coordinated block. An invariant plane strain shape change.
The soldier theory is winning. We've got the look, we've got the movement, but they didn't stop there. They went into the math. Crystallography.
Right. This is where we look at the relationship between the parent lattice, the austenite, and the product lattice, the ferrite. If this is a mechanical displacive transformation, there has to be a strict mathematical relationship between them.
They have to lock together in a specific way.
Precisely. The paper talks about the Bain region. This refers to a specific range of crystallographic orientations. You can think of it as a permissible zone.
So you can't just rotate the crystals any which way.
No. The paper states the rotation between the planes must not be more than 11 degrees.
A very tight window. Did acicular ferret pass the test?
With flying colors.
Mm.
They took 32 separate measurements. Every single one fell within that Bain region.
And they got even more specific, didn't they?
They did. The measurements clustered within just 6 degrees of a very specific relationship, known as the Kurjumov-Sachs relationship.
Kurjumov-Sachs. Sounds like a law firm.
It's a famous orientation relationship in metallurgy. It defines a very precise lockstep between the parent and child crystals. Finding this confirms that the two lattices are related by deformation. The atoms were mechanically shifted into this alignment.
So the math checks out. We have the look, the movement, and the math, but there's one last check, thermodynamics.
Section 5, the thermodynamic limit. This basically asks the question, when does the reaction stop?
And usually a reaction runs until it hits equilibrium, right? It uses up all the available energy.
Correct. In steel, that equilibrium line is called the AE3 curve. If a secular ferrite grew by diffusion, it would just keep going until the carbon and the remaining austenite hit that line. It would squeeze out every last drop of energy.
But looking at figure 7b in the paper, that is not what happened.
Not at all. The growth stopped much, much earlier. It stopped when the carbon concentration reached the T-dollar curve.
Okay, we need to define that. What is the T-dollar curve?
The T-dollar curve is the point where the free energy of the parent phase and the product phase are equal, but, and this is the key, assuming no change in composition. It's a thermodynamic limit that applies specifically to diffusionless transformations.
So let me get this straight. If it was a wanderer diffusion, it would go all the way to the end of the line, the AE3. But because it's a soldier, displacive, it hits this T0 prime wall much earlier.
Exactly. It runs out of thermodynamic driving force because it's constrained by the need to transform without any long-range diffusion. It hits the physical limit for a shear transformation.
But wait, the paper does mention carbon redistribution. If it's diffusionless, how is carbon moving around? That sounds like a contradiction.
That is a crucial point, and it trips a lot of people up. The actual transformation, the flip from the austenite crystal structure to the ferrite structure, is diffusionless. It happens instantly. It's faster than carbon can move. However, once that little plate of ferrite has formed, it is effectively supersaturated with carbon. It's holding way more carbon than it wants to.
So the carbon gets kicked out.
Afterwards, yes. The carbon is rejected from the newly formed ferrite into the austenite that's still around it. But that happens after the transformation.
I see. So the soldier snaps into position instantly. That's the transformation. Then he drops his heavy backpack. That's the carbon diffusion.
That is actually a very good analogy. The sequence is the key.
Yeah.
The structural change is fast and coordinated. The chemical change, the carbon movement, happens later.
Okay, so let's recap for the final verdict. One, it has subunits, so it looks like bainite.
Check.
Two, it creates surface relief, so it moves like bainite.
Check.
Three, it follows the Kurjumov-Sachs rule, so the math lines up. And four, it stops at the TRL wall, so its thermodynamics match. So what is a secular ferrite?
The conclusion is definitive. A secular ferrite is bainite.
Dainite.
It is specifically intergranular bainite.
That feels almost anticlimactic. If it's just bainite, why does it look so different? Why does it even have a special name?
Because in material science, how it looks, the morphology, is what dictates its performance. Normal bainite nucleates at the austenite grain boundaries.
The walls of the room, the cracks in the tile.
Exactly. And because it grows from a flat surface, it organizes itself into neat parallel packets or sheaves, like books on a shelf.
But a secular ferrite grows on those inclusions, the dust motes floating in the middle of the room.
Correct. Because it starts from a point source, it radiates outward. And because you have lots of these inclusions, you get plates growing in all directions, crashing into each other.
Hard impingement again.
That's the one. And this chaotic interlocking structure is the direct result of that intragranular nucleation. And importantly, this chaos is precisely what gives the weld its toughness.
Explain that connection for you, the listener. Why is a chaotic basket weave better than neat parallel lines?
Well, think about a crack trying to move through the metal. A crack always wants the path of least resistance. If it hits a packet of parallel bainite sheaves, it can just zip right along between the plates. It's a straight highway for failure.
But with a secular ferrite?
The path is tortuous. The crack has to constantly change direction. It hits one plate, has to turn, hits another, turns again. It has to navigate this interlocking maze.
And every time the crack has to turn, it loses energy.
Precisely. And that absorption of energy is what we call toughness. The chaos makes the steel resistant to catastrophic failure.
So to recap our deep dive, we started with a mystery from 1987. Scientists knew this structure, a secular ferrite, was good, but they didn't know why. Strangwood and Fedacia proved it's a displacive mechanism. It is essentially just bainite that grows on the inside instead of from the edge.
That's a great summary. And the reason this matters for you is that understanding this mechanism allows metallurgists to actually engineer better steel.
How so?
Once you know how it forms, you can control it. By controlling the types and number of inclusions, those impurities, you can force the steel to form this tough structure. You can design the weld chemistry to make sure those nucleation sites are there.
It really flips your view on impurities. you think clean steel is strong steel. But here, without those little oxide specks, you don't get the nucleation sites, you don't get the chaos, and you end up with a brittle weld.
It's a great reminder that purity isn't always the goal for performance. Sometimes the interaction between different components is what gives you the properties you need.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought. We talked a lot about hard impingement, these plates crashing into each other, blocking each other's growth, creating a chaotic mess. Usually we think of conflict and collision as destructive.
Especially in structural engineering, yes.
Right. But in this case, that internal conflict is exactly what makes the material strong. The plates lock together because they collided. The strength comes from the fact that the structure isn't uniform and perfect.
It's a valid observation. The resistance to unhindered growth is what creates the structural integrity.
If you want to see the actual Nomarski images we talked about, the ones showing the buckled surface of the steel check, the source material we've linked, it really is worth seeing the physical proof for yourself.
And remember, the rigor of that methodology is what separates a good idea from a proven mechanism.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden architecture of steel. We'll catch you on the next one.